Well, we come to the life of Elisha, part 7. And we come to those remaining episodes in chapter 4. Now, there are two episodes concerned with food and famine. Two episodes where the miracles are public. They're not like the other ones behind closed doors. And two episodes where the blessings flow out from Elisha to the community through the hands of his servants. So what are we to make of it? Well, remember the big picture as we come to chapter 4. We've said this before, but think of a protective bubble. You can live under the sea inside a protective bubble. You can live in space inside a protective bubble. Harmful environments are rendered harmless inside a protective bubble. Now, if the whole world lies under the curse of God, unprotected and under judgment, then Israel, the covenant people of God, they live under this protective bubble. Life in the promised land is life inside the bubble, securing your immunity from much of the curse. So they're safe from famine, disease, infertility, disaster. Life inside the bubble is as close as it's possible to get in a fallen world, as close as it's possible to get to Eden. But of course, bubble life, covenant blessing, depends upon obedience. That's how the old covenant worked. So what happens when the covenant people rebel? Well, that protective bubble is torn, and the curse pours in. Isn't that what we witness here in chapter 4? Everyday people, families, communities, they're touched by the curse. So here's Israel. Remember by now the kingdom split into two, the northern kingdom, but they're a covenant-breaking people living outside the blessing of God. The bubble is torn. The curse has poured in to the promised land. So what's Elisha's response? Well, he restores the bubble, at least selectively. Here in chapter 4, for individuals, families, communities, the curse is driven backwards and the blessing returns. So in this chapter, Elisha is re-establishing the bubble. Now, well, that's by way of reminder. So please have now chapter 4 and verses 38 to 44 open in front of you as we look at these final two episodes. We've got 2 points this morning, and the first is an obvious question to ask: what actually happens? Let's look again at what goes on. So first off, verses 38 to 41... vegetable stew. And don't you love this expression in verse 40? Man of God, there's death in the pot. I don't know what the application is, especially with a church lunch today. Maybe it's to avoid church lunches or vegetarian stews or whatever. I'm sure it's not. So, verse 38. And Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in the land. A famine in the land. So we know there's a hole in the bubble, don't we? And the curse has poured in. The curse is here. What's more, this is Gilgal. Now that's highly significant. Because Gilgal was the place where hundreds of years before, the Israelites, having entered the promised land, they first ate the produce of Canaan. So Joshua chapter 5 and verse 10, we read, "Now the children of Israel camped at Gilgal, and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. And they ate of the produce of the land on that day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year." So think of it. At Gilgal, 2 million people plus dining out on the abundance of the land. The manna stopped. No longer did they need to be provided from bread from heaven, because the land itself would provide everything they need. Think of it. Just dining out on the abundance of the promised land. But now, here in Gilgal, there's a famine. And then at Gilgal, 2 million people, they could go out, they could gather whatever they wanted. They could eat it freely, nothing poisonous, nothing dangerous. But here we read of poisonous vines. See the significance of all this. It's saying, look, the curse really is here. Well, verse 38, everyone's hungry. So Elisha, obviously it's a famine, Elisha says to his servant, put on a large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets. So a stew for the sons of the prophets. Great. Just what we need, but what are you going to put in it? So let's go foraging. And verse 39, so one went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine. And gathered from it a lapful of wild gourds, came and sliced them into the pot of stew, though they did not know what they were. Now, someone suggested that this wild vine is Citrullus colcinthus, which apparently produces yellow gourds like small melons, which act as a strong laxative and worse. Well, verse 40, the stew is served to our hungry prophets. Men and food, food and men. What's the way to a man's heart? It is very often through his stomach. You can always cheer up men with food, can't you? Give men a full stomach and they can face anything. In fact, men have a higher metabolic rate than women, so they need refueling more often. And I remember I used to go out on walking holidays with male friends, and you found a friend who started getting grumpy and irritable and all the rest of it. It was usually because he had a low blood sugar level. So give him a Mars bar, give him a piece of cake, and he'd brighten up, he'd be absolutely fine. Some people appear to have permanently low blood sugar levels, but anyway. But can you see the scene? There's all these famished men, all with their low blood sugar levels. And they're smelling the stew. And you can just watch their faces, can't you, as it's being served. And as you look around that circle of faces, having tasted the stew, they cry out as with one voice, verse 40, man of God, there's death in the pot. And they could not eat it. It's bitter, unpalatable, poisonous. And to starving men, can things get any worse? And now every eye is upon Elisha. What's he going to do? Verse 41. Then he said, bring some flour. And he put it into the pot. And he said, serve it to the people that they may eat. And there was nothing harmful in the pot. He doesn't throw the stew away. It's the curse. Nothing you can do with it. On the contrary, he doesn't throw the stew away. He drives the curse away. Now, why the flour? Is it a bit of showmanship? You know, you've got to do something. Does the flour counteract the poison? Well, this really is a miracle. But if these wild gourds speak of the curse, there's death in the pot. There may be something cultivated, something purified like flour, speaks of the blessing which drives away the curse. Something from outside the curse to remove the curse. Maybe that's the symbolism. You can make your mind up, right? It's not terribly clear, is it? The point is this. Is the action of Elisha drives the poison, drives the curse away. And then there's a bit of a surprise in verse 41. Did you pick it up? Because having made the harmful stew harmless, Elisha then says, serve it to the people that they may eat. So what began verse 39 as a meal for the sons of the prophets, put on a large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets, ends up as a meal for the wider community. Serve it to the people that they may eat. And there was nothing harmful in the pot. So the blessing obtained by Elisha actually flows out to the community. But it flows out to the community through the hands of the sons of the prophets. If you like, there's Elisha. The blessing comes from God, but it flows out through Elisha to his disciples, the sons of the prophets, and through the disciples to the wider community, to the people. Now think about the significance of that. But just a brief lesson at this point, verse 39 again. So one went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it a lapful of wild gourds, came and sliced them into the pot of stew, though they did not know what they were. Now the words what they were If you look, some Bibles will have them in italics. In other words, they're not there in the original. They've been put in to try and help give the sense of it, but maybe they're obscuring the sense of it. Because it actually says, gathered from it a lapful of wild goods, came and sliced them into the pot of stew, though they did not know. So it appears that our man doesn't double check with everyone else before he adds these goods. Just gets on with it. And nearly poisons them all. The mistake he made could have been fatal, couldn't it? You could say this man, he messed up big time. I wonder how he'd be handled at Amiens Park. I wonder what people say to him. Nearly poisoned everyone, hasn't he? Would it be sharp words, harsh words, condemning words? So much so that he'd never attempt anything ever again? Would he never be allowed to forget it? That day we nearly poisoned us all? But Christian friends, wasn't he busy serving? Wasn't he doing his best? Wasn't he obeying Elisha's word? His intentions were good, weren't they? And God was in it all the time, because actually his big mistake becomes the occasion for even greater blessing. Now, Christian friends, let this man's failure liberate you. It's a very liberating passage, this, I think. We can become so risk-averse that we never attempt anything for God, because we fear we're going to fail. We can be so concerned to avoid the blame, because if things go wrong, it's going to come back to me, that we never take the initiative. And sometimes in church life, we can be so stressed about things, as though I've got to have the perfect marriage, and the perfect children, and the perfect home, and I've got to serve the Lord in this church in a perfect way, and I've got to have a successful job, and I've got to be the perfect Christian, and I'm not allowed to make any mistakes. And inside we're falling apart. Christian friends, life is messy. Life's full of mistakes. Church life is messy. Church life is full of mistakes. With the best intentions in the world, we get it wrong, don't we? But it's okay. And it should be okay at Amiens Park. Now, you know what I'm not saying? I'm not saying, therefore, it's okay to be half-hearted, slapdash, uncommitted, and I can't be bothered. But we're to be at ease, aren't we, when genuine mistakes are made. Okay, with hindsight, we would have done it differently. Okay, with hindsight, we should have checked with everyone. But so often we're just seeking to serve, weren't we? So let's calm down. Our well-intentioned mistakes don't derail the kingdom. On the contrary, they may become the occasion for the Lord to work in a wonderful way and for his blessings to abound. So let this passage liberate you. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to get it wrong. It doesn't derail the kingdom. But if this man's failure is to liberate us, it also is perhaps for some of us to hold us back. I wonder what a suspicious mind would have made of this man's actions. He's trying to poison me. Or one of those who was nearly poisoned held a grudge. There he goes again, he's died again. I knew he couldn't trust him. So Christian friend, when you witness the mistakes of others, before you wade in, before you sharpen your tongue, before you give them a verbal dead leg, and it goes on in some parts of this church quite often, I get people coming to me very discouraged because so-and-so's had a go at them. So-and-so thought they put them right on something. So-and-so would say this to them. It's taken the heart out of them. So stop! Okay, it's a mistake, but no one died. And God is in our mistakes. God clears up our messes. He does it here, doesn't he? He even turns our mistakes for our good and his glory. So So don't crush your brother or sister when actually they were trying to do their best. There are some people out there, and you always made to feel as though you've done something wrong. A stern sisterhood, a censorious brotherhood. And somehow you've got to win them back. Well, I don't know what I've done wrong. And if you get it wrong in the past, they won't let you forget it. That doesn't sound to me like Christians, does it? That's how the world works. That's what I learned in the world. We don't learn that from Christ. And anyway, Christian friend, beware. What does Jesus say? With the measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. So if you're quick off the mark, God will deal with you in the same way. Next time, you may have cause to be thankful when someone deals gently with your mistakes. Well, that's episode number one. What of episode number two? A man with the barley buns. Verse 42. Then a man from Baal, is it Shalishah? Came from Baal, Shalishah, and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley bread and newly ripened grain in his knapsack. And we're tempted to say, praise the Lord, aren't we? Baal Shalishah, in a town that's known for its devotion to Baal, it's actually got Baal's name in its title, there's a believer. Isn't that wonderful? God is his people in the most unexpected of places, isn't he? So this believer, perhaps himself the first fruits of a greater harvest, he comes to Elisha with the first fruits of the barley harvest. Doesn't go to Baal. Doesn't go to the state-sponsored religion, the cult of the golden calf. Comes to Elisha. Because in Israel, the northern kingdom, God is found with Elisha. That's where God's presence is found, with his prophet. He's the man of God. That's where God's blessing flows. If you like, Elisha's like a mobile tabernacle where the grace of God is to be found. Now, it says here 20 loaves. Now, if you go down to Greg's bakery or any other bakery and you ask for 20 loaves, you'll have your arms full, won't you? But these loaves arrive in this man's knapsack. So they're no bigger than buns. Now, in the good times, when there isn't a famine, that's not very much, is it? Just 20 buns. But in time of famine, that's substantial. So what does Elisha say to his servant? Verse 42, give it to the people that they may eat. And the servant is staggered. Verse 43, but the servant said, what? Have you ever said that to somebody? What? Say that again? 20 barley buns to feed 100 starving men? And says Elisha, verse 43, you heard me right the first time. He said again, give it to the people that they may eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over. Get on with it. Which are you going to believe? What you see with your eyes or what the Lord has said? Are you walking by sight or are you walking by faith? He's saying to his servant, which is more reliable, your eyes or the word of the Lord? Which is more reliable? Verse 44, and he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over according to the word of the Lord. As the servant hands out the food, so it seems to multiply in his hands. So there's enough for everyone. Actually, it's more than enough. There are leftovers, just as God said. So, Christian friends, leftovers. God says, when you eat at my table, you'll always be full, satisfied, content. And therefore, says God, when you eat at my table, there'll always be leftovers. So, Christian friends, when we give hospitality, let's not be too worried if we find we've provided more than enough. It's okay to have leftovers. Leftovers, it's a God-like thing, isn't it? Because when you eat at God's table, there are always leftovers. So what began as 20 barley loaves and some newly ripened grain ends up as a feast for the wider community. The blessing obtained by Elisha flows out to the community, and it does so through the hands of his servant. Indeed, as those blessings flow out from Elisha to the community, they actually multiply in the hands of the servant. So it's the same pattern we saw in the first episode, isn't it? There's Elisha, where the blessings originate, where they come from God, but through Elisha, then out to the servant, and then to the people. Enough for everyone, and more. Again, think of the significance of that. Okay, to our second point then. And it's simply, what's the lesson of these two episodes? What's it teaching us? Well, episode number one. At Gilgal, where once people could freely eat the produce, the abundance of the land, not only is there now a famine, but poisonous vines freely grow. So we know the bubble is torn, the curse is here. But it's actually saying more than that. Because in Deuteronomy 32, Moses describes the wicked, idolatrous nations as a wild, poisonous vine. Now, we sang some of Deuteronomy 32 in the hymn we just sang before the message, 909. But later on in that Song of Moses, he talks about the wicked nations in these words. He says, "For their vine is of the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall, their clusters are bitter." So do you see? Wicked, idolatrous nations, how are they described? They're described as bitter, poisonous vines. So, do you see the point? This episode is a metaphor for what Israel has become. It's not just that now that wild, poisonous vines grow in the promised land, but Israel herself, and remember how Scripture speaks of Israel, she's spoken of as a vine which the Lord plants in the promised land. So Israel herself, planted by the Lord in the promised land, what has she become? She herself has become a wild vine producing bitter, poisonous fruit. She's no better than Sodom and Gomorrah. So how is this wild vine of Israel to be changed, to be cultivated, to produce good fruit? How is the poison that she's producing to be counteracted? How is the curse to be reversed? Through the ministry of Elisha. But hang on a minute. Elisha's only one man. What is he among so many? Well, what did we see? Verse 38, "Put on the large pot and boil the stew for the sons of the prophets." Verse 41, "Then bring some of the flour." He put it into the pot and said, "Serve it to the people that they may eat." So what begins as a stew for the sons of the prophets ends up as a meal for the whole community. But it's a meal that's served to the whole community by the sons of the prophets. In other words, if the blessings are won by Elisha, then those blessings will flow out to the people through the hands of his disciples, through the hands of the sons of the prophets, his servants. As his servants obey Elisha's word, as they fulfill their ministry, so the curse is reversed and the wild vine of Israel is made fruitful. Elisha's ministry is to reach into Israel through his servants. But then that raises another question, doesn't it? Hang on a minute. Okay, he's got his servants. We've gone from one now to effectively just a drop in the ocean, just a handful of people. They're so few, aren't they? How can so few have an impact upon so many? Well, that's where the second episode comes in, verse 43. But his servant said, "What? Shall I set this before 100 men? He said again, "Give it to the people that they may eat, for thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over." So the word of the Lord the bread multiplies in the hand of the servant until all are satisfied. So how can a handful of men reach the nation? By obeying the word of the Lord. And as they serve, so they will find their little will actually multiply in their hands, enough for all the people. So these two episodes, these two miracles, they're teaching bigger truths. They're saying that covenant blessings, the reversal of the curse, is going to flow out from Elisha. Remember, Elijah just says, destroy the lot of them. Nothing can be done with Israel. Destroy it. Elisha has a different ministry. It's a ministry of grace. Covenant blessings flow out from Elisha to the nation. How are they going to reach, though, through the nation of Israel? How is it going to be done? Those blessings are going to reach the nation through the hands of his servants. But what are they amongst so many? They will find that the blessings will actually multiply in their hands. So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over according to the word of the Lord. So Christian friends, what about us? This is not Israel, is it? This is the United Kingdom. It's not a covenant nation. But the curse is here, isn't it? And this is a wicked nation. And it's producing poisonous, bitter fruit. And we don't follow Elisha, do we? No, because one greater than Elisha is here. So, Christian friends, if the blessings of his kingdom are to flow to this cursed, wicked community and beyond, he will do it through our hands as we obey his word and fulfill our calling. And before we say, well, we need to be better resourced, there aren't many of us, we can't do much. Remember, if Elisha could feed 100 men with 20 loaves, our Jesus feeds 5,000 men plus with just 5 loaves. But it's enough, isn't it? Enough for there to be 12 baskets of leftovers. So we must do what we can do. We must press the little that he's given to us into his service. We must use what he has placed into our hands today. And as we do, so the blessings will flow from Christ, and they'll multiply in our hands to satisfy the many, and his kingdom will come. As Jacob once said, small things bring big blessings. Are you skeptical? 20 years ago, a 20-year-old Christian witnessed to a fortune teller under a tree. 20 years later, from that one conversation, there are now 29 churches, over 1,200 children in Sunday schools, pastors in training, children's homes, and a mother church of over 300 believers. Who did it? Well, the one who is greater than Elisha. The Lord did it. But the blessings have flowed and they've multiplied through the hands of his servants. That day, Jachin didn't have much. He's just a young believer. He's just a 20-year-old man. There's a fortune teller sitting under a tree. I'll go and talk to him. I'll tell him about Jesus. The fortune teller seems very keen to talk to him about his future. But I'll talk about something better, something more, something greater. He didn't have much, but he used what he had, didn't he? He told another about Jesus. 20 years later, 29 churches. But it began one day with just one conversation. Some years ago, Len Tuffin. Len was an elder here and went to glory in 2003 in his mid-90s. But Len knocked on a door offering a copy of the magazine, the Good News magazine, which this church used to produce. Knocked on the door. When the person opened the door, They said there was something about this elderly man. There was a reticence he had. There was an attractiveness about him, which they said later they understood and they could see was Christ-likeness. Just an old man knocking on a door, offering a magazine. But Len came back to that person, visited again. And this person was invited to come to Amiens Park Chapel. And they came to Amiens Park Chapel. And they were converted. And since then, 11 other people, a number of whom are members in this church, 11 other people have been converted through that witness. See, the blessings of Christ have just multiplied, haven't they? They've flowed and multiplied in the hands of his servants. What just began as a knock on a door. There were a group of youths and they were shouting, jeering at a stranger on the other side of the road. But the stranger didn't put his collar up and keep hurrying on. The stranger stopped, turned, looked at these young people, crossed the road, went up to them, was friendly, talked to them. But he was so friendly and so different, he invited them to come along to his church. And one of them came along to the youth group, got converted. He's now a pastor of a thriving church which has seen many conversions. That's the way God does it, isn't it? Think of it, just one conversation under a tree. An elderly gentleman who's reticent, who doesn't find this easy, knocks on a door. A frightening situation, but a believer willing to cross the road. It's not much, is it? Not much to start from. But it's how blessings, Christ's blessings, come. It's how the work of the kingdom is done. It's how communities and nations are transformed. So what was going on here goes from Elisha to his servants to the wider community. It happens now. It goes from Jesus, one greater than Elisha, to his disciples, to the wider community. So, Christian friend, what of you? What did Andrew say to Jesus as he looked at that little lad's lunch? He literally thought, got 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes. And he looks up and can just see heads and faces just stretching out in all directions. And he says, what are they among so many? But when it was pressed into the Lord's service, it was enough, wasn't it? So, Christian friends, do we need more resources? More energy, more dynamism, more time, more giftedness, more flair, more maturity. Well, you can tick all those boxes, fine, yes. But actually, what we really need is we need to simply press what the Lord has placed into our hands today and press it now into his service. That's what we need to do. Can you do that? It's not much, is it, what's in your hands? But press into the Lord's service. So today, turn to the visitor. Don't hurry past with a quick nod. Turn to the visitor. Smile. Say hello. This afternoon, come and give out spotlight. It only needs one door to be receptive, doesn't it? You might say, well, we've handed out thousands. No one has. Just needs one door. And if you feel our unity is lacking, invite someone back. We say, well, I haven't got anything in. Well, okay, we'll begin with a cup of tea and a custard cream. And your unfriendly neighbour, pray for 1 minute a day for an opportunity to speak to them. Or do something that's a bit bizarre these days. Take round a cake that you've baked. Smile. Talk about the weather. Begin somewhere. Think of it, if all the believers who met at Amiens Park Chapel were friendly to the neighbour on this side and friendly to the neighbour on that side, that's what, 250 people plus that are now in contact with Christians? What might God do with that? And the open air, well, I can never preach in the open air. Far too nerve-wracking, okay. But could you stand just in that circle of people who listen? With those in the open air. And what of that child that nobody notices? But you've noticed them, haven't you? You've seen them. Why don't you pray for them? Why don't you befriend them? Why don't you take time with them? Who knows, they may grow up to become great in the kingdom of God. And you're giving. I haven't got very much. Well, I don't give, I haven't got much. Well, take your 10p and press it into his service. And God will multiply it. And your commitment to the Lord's work. You think, well, I'm always so busy, I've got so much to do, and so on. Well, just give 10 minutes a week. Just say, I can give 10 minutes a week. I can do that for the Lord. I give 10 minutes of service to the Lord at Amy and Parr Chapel a week. I could do that. I'll see what the Lord will do with your 10 minutes. Maybe you feel, oh, I don't come to the prayer meeting because I never have the time. Well, just try coming for a month. Because you commit to a month. Not 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, the next 20, 30 years. Just come for a month. Could you commit for a month? Who knows what God might do? And you look at this nation, you say, well, it's just getting worse and worse, isn't it? Things seem to be getting desperate. Well, could you pray for the nation just for 5 minutes a week? Could you write just one letter a month? Could you talk to just one person about Jesus? Do you see the point? Andrew says, what are they among so many? And it's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. It's the servant saying to Elijah, what? This for that lot? But press the little that you have into the Lord's service today. So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. That, brothers and sisters, is how we do the work of the kingdom. Let's sing a hymn.